From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, why this cold and snowy November is actually evidence the Earth's temperature is rising.
And a new film says that unless we do something to avoid it, humans may cause the next mass extinction on Earth.
The scientific community that I joined in making this documentary would say, yes, there's the possibility of avoiding a mass extinction. There are lots of species that can be saved. We just really have got to make a commitment to it.
Then comets are the oldest building blocks of planets in the solar system.
These are objects that mostly froze out of what we call the solar nebula, so the cloud that formed the sun and the planets early on in its history at the outskirts of the solar system.
And making the case for East to meet West at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. People around the state are still extracting themselves from an early season snowstorm this morning, and now the cold weather is returning. Temperatures, which reached 50 degrees over the weekend, are expected to climb no higher than the low 20s by Thanksgiving Day. November has seemed like a strong argument against the idea of a warming climate.
But George Stone says our cold weather this month is actually more evidence the Earth's temperature is on the rise. And there's another counterintuitive weather phenomenon going on as well. Stone teaches natural science at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's an occasional Lake Effect contributor. He explains what's going on here.
Well, the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on the planet. We know that. That's well documented. And as most of the evidence for climate change is, it's based on measurements, not opinions. So the Arctic's warming very much, and it's having the effect of, at times, pushing the Arctic cold air masses farther south than they would otherwise have been at the season. And so the meteorologists are always talking about the jet stream, but actually the jet stream flows along the boundaries of air masses. And the jet stream marks the position, the southern, and as it crosses North America at this time of year, it marks the southern extent of the Arctic air or the polar air mass. And so it's just that the warming in the Arctic is having the counterintuitive effect of causing colder weather farther south by pushing this cold air mass farther than it would be on the average at this time of season.
Is it oversimplifying things to say that if we look at temperatures in the Arctic, they are warmer than usual, even as the temperatures here are
cooler
than usual?
Yes, there have been record highs set up in Alaska in the last month or so. So that is correct. There are results that people would not normally expect. But I think the main point to get across to everyone is that the planet Earth, is warming. Our energy balance is positive. That is to say, we are absorbing more heat from the sun than we are radiating back into space. And if you're absorbing more heat than you're radiating back, there's no choice. You're going to be warming up.
And so we mentioned there were a couple of counterintuitive pieces of evidence. Another one is the fact that reportedly there is more sea ice than there has been in recent years in the Antarctic. And that on its surface, to use an appropriate metaphor, would seem like a good thing.
Well, it's just the opposite of what's happening in the Arctic. The Arctic sea ice has, on the average, been trending down, less and less sea ice cover, much of it melting off during the summer season than previous records. And we set an all-time record just 2 years ago in 2012 when the sea ice in the Arctic diminished dramatically. That's part of the overall effect of a warming Arctic, and much of that's being driven by the albedo effect. As the sea ice melts and exposes more water, and as the snow and ice on the land melt and expose more soil and rock, those are darker surfaces, and they in turn absorb more radiation rather than reflecting it like the snow and ice normally do. So that's kind of a positive feedback in the Arctic region that's contributing to that warming. In the Antarctic, on the other hand, the fringe of sea ice or frozen ocean surrounding Antarctica has been increasing. And recent studies have shown that, surprisingly, that's due to global warming because the deeper ocean water is warming. That's melting some of the glacial ice around Antarctica. And that melting produces fresh water, which when it mixes with the ocean water, raises the freezing temperature. So more ocean water diluted by the melting fresh water is freezing, and the sea ice is expanding. Just what, you know, it's kind of, we say it's counterintuitive because warming you expect to produce less ice, as it's doing in the Arctic.
At the same time, even if it's evidence of a warming climate, is it a good thing that there is more ice?
Well, it's not good for the tourist industry down there. I mean, you may recall last year one of the tourist ships, they call themselves eco-tourism tours. They take people down to look at the penguins, and I can't complain about that. I did that myself 2 years ago, and it's marvelous. A trip to Antarctica is unbelievable, experience of a lifetime. But it is more dangerous for the ships that want to go in and send their rubber rafts, their Zodiacs, in to land on the beaches and actually set foot on the continent of Antarctica or on the Antarctic Peninsula. So it's a somewhat of a hazardous for that aspect of it. But I'm not sure if it's beneficial generally. It's another indication that the planet is warming.
There is also another piece of conventional wisdom debunking, if you will, that's also on your radar. And in addition to the climate change issue that you were just talking about, the dinosaur extinction millions of years ago, we've understood in a certain way for a long time. But now there is something that is challenging that conventional wisdom as well, correct?
Well, that's true, Mitch. And in the 1970s, a layer was discovered in Italy and then in many other places around the world. That dated back to 65 million years ago, which is when the dinosaurs and many other species became extinct. It wasn't just the dinosaurs. About at least 50% of all the species on this planet became extinct at that time.
I forget, was this the Permian extinction?
No, this was the KT, Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction. The Permian extinction was 250 million years ago. And that was the greatest of all when 90% of the species disappeared. But the dinosaur extinction, of course, I said thank God for dinosaurs because that's how we get many of our new earth scientists and geologists. Kids love dinosaurs. They get interested in dinosaurs, and then some of them will want to learn about the evidence and study dinosaurs. There's pretty strong evidence. I attended the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America this past October in Vancouver, British Columbia, and there were two sessions on mass extinctions, major sessions, in which a lot of evidence was presented showing that the impact of the asteroid on the northern tip of Yucatan at a village called Chicxulub, that actually predated the extinction by some 300,000 years. And evidence in other parts of the world doesn't correlate. It doesn't match up. The timing is off. There have been major studies of a huge lava field in India called the Deccan Traps by groups in Princeton University in New Jersey and another universities around the world, showing that these were truly humongous, voluminous eruptions that contributed tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide gas to the atmosphere, enough to change the chemistry of the oceans. And many of the species that became extinct at the same time as the dinosaurs were invertebrates that lived in the oceans. And they can trace this as a gradual process over a longer period of time that predated the asteroid impact. And so I would say the consensus, this has been somewhat controversial. The leader of this research group at Princeton is a woman named Gerda Keller. And I can remember 10 years ago when she was regarded as a heretic and a crackpot, you know, because she had the audacity to challenge this hypothesis, this explanation, which had been developed by the Alvarez, Louis Alvarez, a physicist, and his son Walter. It was so popular and appealing to the general public and to geologists, and had been widely accepted. But here, Gerda has been coming back. They're doing more and more research, her graduate students, postdocs, other people at other universities. And, hey, the evidence is piling up. It's a great example of the scientific method, where a previous explanation may have to be modified or even thrown out altogether if the evidence shows that it's not feasible. So that's what's happening here. It's a great lesson in the scientific method.
And to bring things full circle, do you think understanding the way that that extinction took place, if indeed it turns out that it was these massive eruptions that changed the content, the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere and radically altered the oceans, does understanding that have ramifications for understanding the way climate change is working today?
Well, yes, of course, but it shows that the changes in atmospheric and oceanic chemistry can have a devastating effect on life. And because life on this planet is a web, it's all interconnected, interrelated, and interdependent, an ecological web, that when one thing changes, it affects everything else. It's like sticking your finger into a spider web. The whole web is affected. So there are lessons there, but as to modern or current global warming, this is happening very, very, very rapidly. These eruptions took place over a period of a couple of million years. The changes that we're effecting in the atmosphere, in the ocean, ocean acidification because of more CO2, are taking place much, much rapid, hundreds of times more rapidly. So that's the big difference.
George Stone, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Mitch. Thank you.
George Stone teaches natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College and is the organizer of the annual Sustainability Summit, which takes place in March. He is also a Lake Effect contributor. Meanwhile, you can find an updated weather forecast at WUWM.com.
A new documentary film produced by a biologist at UW-Madison says that humans could be the cause of the next mass extinction. We'll learn more after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect returns on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Five times in the Earth's past, cataclysmic events nearly extinguished most species. These phenomena are called mass extinctions. Scientists have recently determined the causes of two of them, an asteroid striking the Earth and the eruption of a supervolcano.
A new documentary, Mass Extinction, Life at the Brink, which premieres this Sunday on the Smithsonian Channel, chronicles those discoveries and carries a warning. Scientists are increasingly concerned that humans could be responsible for a future mass extinction.
Evolutionary biologist Sean B. Carroll is the film's executive producer, and he also runs a lab at UW-Madison. That's where WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz reached him. He explained why looking so far back is critical to the Earth's future.
The reason to look back in time is that mass extinctions are extraordinary events. Biologists and geologists have known about them for a long time. And the question everyone would ask is, you know, what does it take to kill off the majority of life on the planet? Shouldn't we know about those things? And really, until about 1980, we didn't have a good clue about what would cause the majority of species to disappear. And then some of the greatest detective work I know about started to unfold. And what's particularly great about geology is that when events happen in the Earth, those events are recorded in rocks, and scientists have to figure out a way to sort of unlock those memories that are inside rocks. And by doing that, over the last 30 years or so, they've been able to figure out the causes of two mass extinctions. And while those causes are different and are fairly exotic to our experience of enormous asteroid or huge volcanic eruptions, they do tell us a really simple message, and that is when environmental change is great enough and fast enough and on a global scale, life is really in trouble. And that's a bit of a hauntingly familiar message to what we're getting from looking at the state of the planet today.
So let's just dip back to the time of the dinosaurs and what, in brief, scientists have discovered.
Well, it was a hint from a chemical in the rocks that was not expected, a chemical called iridium, that clued researchers that something had impacted from outer space, because iridium is rich in things like asteroids but rare on the Earth. But it took 10 or 11 years to find the impact site, which is in the Yucatan in Mexico. And until that impact site was found, there was a lot of doubt of whether or not a large asteroid had struck the Earth. once that impact site was found and people understood the scope of the impact and what that would do in terms of blasting debris out of the atmosphere and having it raining back down on the planet, and hundreds of places around the globe have been found where that debris had rained back down, we started to develop a picture of what kind of cataclysmic event that asteroid impact was and how it destroyed habitat. 50 or 60% of plant species went extinct. And if you think about it, it's pretty easy to knock off, you know, 10 or 20,000 large dinosaurs. It's really hard to make a plant go extinct because, of course, they can grow back from seeds and things like that. So when plants go extinct, I think that's telling us something, that the conditions on the planet were really, really tough. And so the whole food chain was compromised both on land and in the ocean. So going back 66 million years gives us a sense of, well, you know, what does it take? Well, it takes something that interferes with the normal functioning of the way food chains work and the way ecosystems work. And like a domino effect, mass extinction can unfold.
So talk about the KT boundary. I mean, give it a little sense of what was found on either side of that boundary.
The KT boundary is a term geologists use for a boundary that's found all over the world, formed by this short period in Earth's history where there had been an impact. Some of the impact debris was deposited, and in the oceans there was sort of a dead zone there. And by studying the life that existed below that layer before the impact and the life that existed after that layer, after the impact, you get a sense of it's really two different worlds. Below that layer, there are dinosaurs and all sorts of other creatures that roamed in times before 66 million years ago. And above that layer, there are no dinosaurs. And as you go further above and come to more recent times, you find the large animals are all mammals. So there was really a dramatic change in the world between what existed before the impact and after the impact. You know, you get sort of a snapshot of two different worlds. And that's what scientists have been doing for the last 30 years.
One could look at that and say, how cool, that was so long ago. I'd like one of those fossils. I mean, you know, how do you bring that front and center to consider the impacts we're having on our environment and habitats?
Well, you need to figure out, well, how could something, it was, you know, the asteroid was 6 miles wide and it hit the Yucatan and drilled a hole about 120 miles wide. But, you know, the Earth is huge. I mean, this is literally, it's almost like hitting a barn with a BB. But it hit with enormous power, unleashed massive amounts of energy, and blew enormous amounts of debris into and out of the atmosphere that circled the globe. And when it rained back down, it essentially rained down, you know, hot rock, setting off wildfires and things like this. And so what we understand from looking at, for example, the ocean record is that tiny little creatures, things at the base of the food chain, were snuffed out. And on land, you know, plants were wiped out. And that's telling you that by blasting stuff into the air that blocked out the sun for some period of time, that rapid change was devastating to life on Earth. And it took a long time, and you can see this in the fossil record, it took a long time for life on Earth to recover to where diversity was somewhere, you know, up close to what it was before the impact, on the order of millions of years. And that's just one example. But if we go back about 250 million years, there was another mass extinction.
That one's called the Great Dying.
The Great Dying. That's probably 90% of plant and animal species disappearing. That, we now know with high confidence from really recent work, was caused by massive volcanic eruptions underneath present-day Siberia. And that just pumped massive amounts of climate-changing gases up into the atmosphere, including massive amounts of carbon dioxide. And we can tell from various traces in rocks that that had dramatic changes on temperatures across the world, both on land and in the ocean. In a relatively short amount of time, probably on the order of tens of thousands of years, the majority of life on the planet went extinct. And what's worrisome to scientists today is that we know that the magnitude of temperature change that happened 250 million years ago is in the realm of what we're facing in the next century or two based on projections of global warming. So we know that, you know, an 8, 10, 12-degree shift in average temperature across the globe is a massive thing that really disrupts the web of life. And so by looking into the past, we understand the cataclysmic effects that environmental change has had in the past. We're trying to arm ourselves with the knowledge of, you know, understanding what we may be facing in the future. And this is why a lot of my colleagues are really anxious, is that the more we've understood about past mass extinctions, even if they were caused by different triggers, like asteroids or volcanoes, they had their effect through a common means, which was unleashing these climate-changing gases and changing the course of life across the Earth.
One of the warning signs of today's situation that is pointed out in your documentary is what's going on in Yellowstone National Park.
Right. We thought it was it'd be valuable to go look at places that are, you know, essentially some of the best protected places on Earth, but they're not immune now to climate change. So first, you know, to be really clear, up until now, the extinction crisis we face with a large percentage of species at risk has really come about through a host of reasons short of climate change. The way we've used habitat for our own uses, or we've harvested creatures, or taken down forests and things like this. Now, so we'd have an extinction crisis even without climate change. But now with climate change, you're adding another complicating factor. And in places like Yellowstone, which has been a refuge for some of the mammals that almost went extinct in North America, things like the grizzly bear or the bison, there's changes taking place in Yellowstone that are directly traceable to climate change. And they're the kind of things that surprise us. You wouldn't necessarily imagine this connection, but it tells you a little bit about how much life is interconnected. And the most, to our eye, the obvious changes in Yellowstone are that very high elevations, the whitebark pine that lives at high elevations, is being decimated. So you're just seeing these large swaths of dead trees on the ranges in Yellowstone. And the reason for that is that they've been attacked by beetles, by pine beetles. And those pine beetles are normal residents of Yellowstone, but what's happened is the winters are not as severe as they used to be, which used to kill off a lot of the beetle larvae. And as things are a little bit warmer, the beetles are going to higher elevations, and the trees at high elevations don't have any natural resistance to the beetles. And so the trees are getting attacked, and they are killed rather quickly. And the reason why that's important is that those trees produce really important food for all sorts of things, squirrels, birds, but also, as it turns out, grizzly bears, who gorge themselves on the seeds of the pine cones of those white bark pine before they hibernate. And so, you know, there's a chain of events. A little bit warmer in Yellowstone, trees are suffering from beetle infestation, and it turns out lots of things are dependent upon those trees. And those are the kind of connections that you know, biologists don't even have a full grasp of, but they're seeing these things happening, and they're happening faster than we expected. The biologists that I've spoken to who were worried about this 8 or 10 years ago are shocked by how quickly things have moved in places like Yellowstone. And when things are happening faster than scientists even feared, you know, their anxiety is going up. But for the moment, what we can do and what individuals can do, and I think this is the hardest thing when bringing up any of these, you know, major issues like this, is what individuals can do is work to help protect things that matter to them locally. Local lakes, those near the seashore, local bays, those involved with parks, any preserve, anything we can do to strengthen the amount of land and water that is being protected is really buys us time. And then over the decades, we're going to have to deal with some of the root causes of the stresses that we're putting on the Earth. And that's, of course, going to take lots of countries at least paddling in the same direction.
For a long, long time, humans were part of nature. Now, at least some of us consider ourselves masters of nature, which is thought-provoking at a minimum.
It's an enormous change for the planet. If you go back, you know, to the early times of our species, even, you know, 10, 12,000 years ago, humans were a relatively not that abundant mammal. You know, our population has exploded. It hit 1 billion for the first time around 1800 and took another 100 years to go to 2 billion. But in the last 100 years, it's gone up to 7.5 billion. And, you know, we consume a lot. We're a large mammal, given our sort of average body weight. And we consume a lot of resources. So, you know, in terms of the balance of things on the planet, there's a lot less resources, space, food, et cetera, available to everything else living on the planet. This one species, our species, has really commanded a lot of things. And we might say, well, you know, that's just the way it is. It's just that a lot of the rest of the things on the planet serve us in purifying our water or feeding us, you know, keeping our shorelines from falling into the ocean. And so even if we just take a very sort of utilitarian view of the rest of nature, these changes are going to affect the systems that support humanity. And that's probably enough reason for most people to really care. If fish populations crash further, there's going to be a lot less food to be harvested from the ocean, and a large amount of the human population depends upon things that they can get from the oceans. We're going to see water shortages in parts of the world that are probably going to really strain, you know, geopolitical situations. So we're going to feel the impacts of this in lots of ways. It's not merely about the moral or aesthetic value that we place on giraffes or leopards or whatever it might be. We're going to feel these impacts because nature provides enormous amounts of services, you know, to humanity.
I'm hearing from what you're telling me, Sean, that the gravity that you see in all this has influenced the evolution of your own career.
Yeah, I think I'll put it really simply. You know, as a 10-year-old, you know, I loved nature programs and I loved going out flipping over logs and things like this, and I decided to become a biologist. And the time since I was that kid and have become a biologist, half of the world's wild populations have vanished. You know, that I sort of feel like that's on my watch. And it's sort of, I think this is, you know, a crisis for, you know, even professional biologists to look around and say, you know, we've made such tremendous understanding in terms of advances in understanding how nature works and life works and tremendous medical advances. But at the same time, we've really degraded the world we're living in. And I felt that I couldn't just sit in my office and either complain or worry about it. I had to figure out something that I could do to contribute.
UW-Madison biologist Sean Carroll is the executive producer of the new film Mass Extinction, Life at the Brink. It premieres on the Smithsonian Channel this Sunday, November 30th.
Carroll spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz, and you'll find more about the film and about Carroll at WUWM.com. Coming up next, what it takes to land on a comet. Our astronomy contributor joins us when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It was big news last week when the European Space Agency landed a probe on a comet. And even with some unexpected difficulties in the landing, the Rosetta mission has already gathered enough data to keep scientists busy for years.
Gene Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium and our regular astronomy contributor. She shares her thoughts about Rosetta's initial successes.
You see the pictures, the videos, and you realize that some of those people in that room have been working on this for 20 years, their whole career. So it's been traveling for 10, but, you know, these projects have a long life before they come to fruition. And from the time that somebody dreamt it to the time it's actually landed, it could be 25 years or more. So if you think about that and the odds, how many things have to go right before something like this works? You can almost imagine the fantastic anxiety and anticipation of a group of people whose dreams and, one could argue, personal livelihood depends on this thing working. And we know that at first the landing of the machine wasn't quite perfect, so it had to bounce off, and, you know, after floating for a mile and coming back again, eventually it hit the ground and it stuck. Amazing.
And on a comet that's moving how fast through space?
Well, that's the thing, right? So you're trying to hit a moving target. You're not quite sure exactly how it's going to stick, what the exact properties are of the comet in advance. I mean, we know that its density was 0.4 grams per cubic centimeter. Just to give you a reference, water is 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So this is less dense than water itself. So we know it's not going to be rock, but ice comes in all kinds of flavors. So if it's terrifically brittle when it hits, it might disintegrate piece of the comet and then the whole thing flies away into space and you kiss goodbye the whole project. Well, I shouldn't say the whole project because this was just a lander, right? Philae was just a lander. The overall mission is called Rosetta. That is the orbiter that's going to be studying the comet. And that, of course, has an independent life, and that was significantly less risky. But because to set Philae to the comet, they had to change the orbit of the orbiter. Now that that part of the mission is done with, now they have to fire up the rockets to change its orbit so that it's at a more circular, if you will, orbit, so that it's steadier and it can safely study the comet for, they hope, for about a year. So the exciting kind of news that came out, other than it successfully landed, was that it looks like they found the first organic molecules. And when we're talking about organic molecules here, we're just talking about molecules that have carbon and hydrogen, the building blocks of life. And we've seen in the past hints that that might be so just by studying the dust of comets, but not directly the comet itself. You've probably heard of the drama that when it eventually stuck to the ground, it didn't quite land the way that would have been ideal. So the solar panels that were going to collect data and sort of recharge the battery weren't getting enough. So they had about 60 hours of operation before the battery basically ran out. And the final hope is that perhaps when the comet comes closer to the sun, that it'll get enough energy possibly to wake it up in time. I get the feeling that this is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's conceivable. It's not impossible.
So what happens if it doesn't wake up? How does that affect the mission?
Well, they already basically got what they were hoping to get. I mean, they have 60 hours of data on the ground on a comet. Well, that is nothing we've ever done before. So this is probably the kind of data that it'll take years before all the ramifications, everybody has analyzed all the data and come to some conclusions. So even though, as I said, it didn't have an extended mission, its primary mission was successful.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's great. And for them to already, I mean, this is, you know, a few days later, to already have an announcement like we found organic molecules is already awesome.
Yeah.
So there are reasons, of course, why we think that comets are so worthwhile. And one of them is we think that some comets might have brought the seeds for life on Earth. I mean, this is something that people talk about quite a bit. And this is one indication that maybe this idea holds some water because we see the organic molecules on the comet right now. This is going to be interesting also in conjunction with the studies of the comet that approached Siding Spring, that approached Mars. Again, this is too recently to have analyzed all the data yet. But as we study this comet that approached Mars and interacted with the atmosphere of Mars, we might see a pattern developing. If that comet also has some organic molecules, and also we see that the atmosphere of that comet did influence the atmosphere of Mars, that might tell us, this could have happened
on
Earth,
too. This could have happened here, too. Okay.
And we can do the experiment safely on Mars because it's far enough from us. We don't worry too much about could this impact the Earth in unpleasant ways. So we did it on the cheap.
And so thinking that this influences or has influenced possibly life on Earth or the creation of life on Earth, this wasn't necessarily a comet striking the Earth. This was just interacting with the atmosphere. Is that what we're thinking?
Okay. That's right. Now, obviously, it would be more likely if the comet struck the Earth, and it could well have been that comets did strike the Earth or other objects from the other parts of the solar system. Early on in the solar system's history, we had a very heavy bombardment period. So the Earth was not a good place to be. A whole lot of debris and large pieces of rock and...
Just ask the dinosaurs.
Exactly. Well, even before the dinosaurs, yeah. When it would have been even worse. We would have just been a man on the mark, continuously bombarded. So we think that, you know, objects certainly large would have been able to fall on the Earth and often. So it could be that that would have been just enough of a starter. And with the chemistry that we have, it could take hold. Yeah.
All right.
The other, of course, interesting thing about comets is that these are the oldest building blocks for planets in the solar system. These are objects that mostly froze out of what we call the solar nebula, so the cloud that formed the sun and the planets early on in its history at the outskirts of the solar system. So it's hard for us to get to them, much easier to visit them if they come closer to us. So that's the idea. And we have flew by Halley's Comet in 1984. The Europeans had a mission there. But it's not the same, of course, as landing, gathering data, drilling holes, doing all these, and much more sensitive equipment to make the measurements. So this is a whole new chapter for us all.
And just, again, I go back to just how cool.
Yes.
That we're seeing this in our lifetime and that we're getting this kind of information and that we have the ability and technology to be able to go there.
We live in exciting times.
We certainly do. Jean Creighton, great to have you back and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
And we'll talk next month.
I look forward to it.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus and our regular astronomy contributor.
You can see photos and videos from the comet, as well as subscribe to Rosetta's Twitter feed from the European Space Agency's Rosetta Mission website. There is a link to it at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then catch up with the executive director of the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. So stick around for more of Lake Effect right after this.
More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Much of the region's arts and culture is concentrated in Milwaukee, obviously. Venues and arts organizations of all kinds and sizes are found across the city. And when people talk about the positive effect the arts have on our schools, economy, and quality of life, they're mostly talking about what's happening in and around downtown.
But professional quality arts don't stop when you hit Milwaukee's borders. Open now for a dozen years, the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield works hard to connect the city with its more westerly neighbors and vice versa. Jonathan Winkle has been the center's executive director since 2007. He says that creating and maintaining that connection isn't always easy.
Because we're in a suburban location and not concentrated with the other arts organizations in Milwaukee, we have an extra challenge in terms of looking at a regional marketplace and making people aware that the center exists. Where is it located? How do I get there? But I think what happens is when people do discover the center, they find that it's in a beautiful, idyllic location. It's a city park, as you know, and there's a conservancy area nearby. And so it really, in a way, very quickly transports you into a very different type of state of mind. And then, of course, you go inside the building. It's beautiful. It has a lodge in the park type of architectural design. And so you have a very, I would say, comfortable experience. And because the center's venues are fairly intimate in size, I think what we can virtually guarantee, not maybe with 100% certainty, but pretty close, that people will have a very high quality experience. There are no bad seats anywhere. The acoustics are great in both of the inside spaces. And it's really a beautiful space to have a cultural experience.
One of the things that I like about it is that it does have that multi-use sense, too. You've got rehearsal rooms. You've got the performance spaces. You've got, at least the last time I was there, art-making spaces as well, not just music. And so that there seems to be a lot of variety available to people as well.
There is a lot of variety, which, of course, makes the messaging part of what we do a little more challenging. Because we're multidisciplinary and we also offer a lot of arts education experiences, people will interface with the center in different ways. So, for example, you might have just been out at the center last Saturday for performance program, but you may be coming in with your child to have violin lessons, or you may be coming to a Plock Art Gallery opening because you have some interest in visual art and you want to have some interaction with that particular artist that we're exhibiting. So there are a number of ways in which we can introduce people to the Wilson Center. And part of our job, of course, is to find ways to cross-sell, if you will. And so if somebody does come in because their child is participating in a musical theater experience from Brookfield Central High School, well, maybe they see a brochure on the reception desk and see an upcoming performance or an upcoming visual art exhibit. They think, oh, that looks interesting. That looks curious. I'd like to go check that out. And so we do have the challenge of how do we effectively communicate all that, but we also have the advantage in that we have a lot of different kinds of experiences for people to have rather than if you're a discipline-specific organization where you really know this is what I'm going to get.
How do you try to connect with Milwaukee as a whole? As you said, you know, that tends to be where most things are centered in the area. I mean, there are some outlying things besides yourself. But is it important for the center to make those connections and to bring people from Milwaukee out to Brookfield?
I think it's incredibly important. And in fact, we've been making some headway in terms of the percentage of people coming from Milwaukee County out to the Wilson Center. So, for example, when I started in the fall of 2007, I would say 17 to 18% of our ticket buyers were coming from Milwaukee County. Now it's about 25 or 26%. And so incrementally, we are becoming increasingly regional. And I think it's important for people to realize that for some of the programming that we offer, especially on the presenting side of the equation, if you will, we may be presenting artists that you may not see in other parts of the Milwaukee metro market or necessarily in the state. So we actually pull people up from Illinois sometimes or over from Madison or the Fox Cities, depending on who we have performing at the center. But I think this idea of a more regional vision is pretty important when you go back to how the center got started. I will describe it as two big ideas coming together that made the place a reality. The first was a group of people who wanted to have performing arts facilities for the students in the Elmbrook Public Schools because those particular buildings didn't have any. So you had that initial group of people who organized. But then you also had a growing need from the downtown Milwaukee arts organizations to look westward. Back in the late 90s, there was a joint GMC-UPAF report that really recommended that there be something done to create some sort of space for the downtown Milwaukee groups to have a west side presence. And so you had donors, investors, if you will, in art and culture that wanted to see that also become a reality. And so those two ideas really came together with the intention of being a regional arts center that would, yes, serve the more immediate community very effectively, but also, I think very much in the spirit of collaboration, reach out to the broader Milwaukee metro area and its colleague organizations and create opportunities for those organizations to perform in Brookfield, where the Wilson Center is located. So we have any number of other performing arts organizations that either currently or have done work at the Wilson Center, from the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra to Present Music, the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra. First Stage Children's Theater runs classes year-round at the Wilson Center. So a lot of groups that are centered downtown actually have a relationship with us and participate either as a performance organization or as an educational organization at the Wilson Center.
What has been some of the biggest challenges in getting people to remember, A, that you're there and that this is a great venue to bring in audiences that might not otherwise see their work?
Well, sure. You're not going to accidentally find the Wilson Center because it's about a mile south of Capitol Drive inside a city park. So you don't typically just, oh, what's this nice-looking building as I'm walking downtown? You don't really have that type of opportunity. So what we have to do is, I think, create programming that's going to be interesting to people that live and look at a more regional metro area. But how do we promote that effectively? And I think that once you can get somebody to take that first step and come and have an experience at the Wilson Center, then we're, of course, much more likely to be able to have that person have a repeat experience. And so that reach and repeat type of activity is very, very critical. And I think the regional marketplace can sustain an organization that falls outside of sort of the concentration of traditional organizations in downtown Milwaukee. And I think we have an opportunity because of where we're located to do some things that are a little different. Because we are in a park, we actually have outdoor programming capacity. And a lot of places really don't have that option because they are in a downtown.
Right. They are restricted by the very nature of the downtownness.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the programming and making it so that people who might not otherwise make the trek to Brookfield from any direction, not just from downtown, but from anywhere, what are the kinds of things that you look to bring to differentiate you from, say, another performing arts center?
Sure. And that's walking a fine line because you have to have enough familiarity to create comfort. But yet at the same time, you want to have opportunities that are different. So, for example, we have multiple subscription series. So our flagship series, if you want to call it that, is what we call the Performing Arts Series. And we have a program the Saturday right after Thanksgiving, which is an a cappella vocal group that we have had at the Wilson Center in the past called Contus. And they were actually also featured, by the way, in the animated feature film Frozen. But they have a really beautiful program that celebrates this really kind of amazing experience that occurred between the soldiers in the first Christmas Eve during World War I. And, of course, this is 2014. It's the 100th anniversary of this particular experience. So Contus has created this program with three additional actors, so 9 singers, 3 actors, where they are performing and reading from diary entries and letters from these soldiers in World War I that had this experience where they celebrated Christmas in no man's land in the middle of a war. And so that's a program that, again, you're not going to find everywhere. And so we're really trying to do some different things. We present major modern dance companies, and I think that's something that we're very proud of that the center's been doing since it opened in 2002. This year we're bringing in Kegwin and Company. Larry Kegwin, the founder and choreographer of this company, he's a rising star in modern dance. His company's only 10 years old, so you may not have heard of it, but we've been monitoring it for 3 or 4 years now and watching what he does with his company. And very high level, very sophisticated, but also fun. Larry has a very keen sense of humor and is very playful at the same time that he may have serious work. And coincidentally, one of his lead female soloists is from Brookfield originally. That was just a happy coincidence.
I was going to say, that's a nice thing when that happens.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's just a quick sampling of some of the different things that we do. And we think that by creating some level of eclecticism, yes, we run the risk of trying to be all things to all people. That's not really what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is create an opportunity for somebody to come to the center and have a high-quality artistic, cultural, entertainment experience. And maybe you're not a dance fan, but maybe you don't realize you're a dance fan. So maybe if you come out to see Kegwin & Company, you realize, oh, maybe I kind of like this modern dance thing. Maybe I should go to the Milwaukee Ballet Company and check out what they're doing. Maybe I should go see Dance Works. I mean, I think there are opportunities for what we do to whet the appetite for somebody that's a patron of the arts, and maybe they go see something else. And so we're constantly looking at that regional level of participation But we're really thinking also in terms of what can we do for that one person that opens their eyes to something that's happening in the world that they did not have any awareness of previously and makes their universe a little bit bigger and more wonderful.
Very quickly, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, do you just see more of the same, or do you have do you hope to grow in a different direction?
We are expanding visual art programming, and in particular, we are moving forward with an initiative that's been in the works for a while, but because we're in a city park and we have a greenway trail system throughout Mitchell Park where the center is located, and we've gotten some seed money from the NEA just recently, we are expanding outdoor sculptural works around the Wilson Center but into Mitchell Park proper. This is going to be a long-term project, but it's going to be a very exciting one because we're going to be initially commissioning a work through a public participation type of process for some Wisconsin resident artist that's a sculptor. And we're starting with a really large-scale piece that will be a part of the entrance area when you drive up to the center, but also beyond that, adding multiple pieces. Some will be interactive in nature. They may be responsive to wind. Water may be involved. They may be what are called ephemeral works that may be intended to break down over time because they're constructed of natural materials. And so I think that that project really has a long-term trajectory. And I think that's very exciting for us to look at. We've also just recently completed our second annual guitar competition at festival, and it's very exciting to see what's happened just in 2 years' time. We had semifinalists invited from not only the United States, which we had a number of wonderful players from around the country, but also the territory of Puerto Rico. We had semifinalists from Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Israel, Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. That's in year two. So I can only imagine what will happen over the next several years as we create that type of opportunity that is actually international in scope. And if people aren't aware of this, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Peck School of the Arts, has a wonderful guitar program. And we've had a lot of interaction on our planning committee from the faculty at the Peck School. And I think that that also is a really wonderful opportunity to have private nonprofit arts organization like the Wilson Center working with one of our major universities in the area and developing this really signature type of event.
And you've got East Side and West Side coming together.
Absolutely. That's right.
Well, Jonathan, I wish you the best of luck with this season. It sounds like a good one. And thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Jonathan Winkle is the executive director of the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today and hoping you'll join us tomorrow. On tomorrow's show, an alarming report about the level of truancy among MPS students. And on a somewhat lighter note, we will meet Alice in Dairyland and find out about some of the unique offerings that Wisconsin producers have going for us this Thanksgiving.
So join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.